is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode, Florida Spectacular. How you doing, Rick?
I'm doing good. It's interesting. You know, I recently got air conditioning up in my office, and now the air conditioning downstairs broke, of course. So it only got to 82 last night. I can't say I slept great, but it can be done.
Why didn't you just sleep in the attic?
I thought long and hard about it. But there is a bed up here, but it's where I do ceramics, and it's potentially full of clay dust. And clay dust is not good. You don't want it in your lungs.
But you work up there all day.
This is a rough time of year for your AC to go out.
It is. It is. They'll be here this afternoon. So, fortunately, our AC company is right down the street, and that's perhaps why we use them. So,
and they're never busy this time of year.
No. But, you know, I'm pleased that it only got to 82 degrees because it didn't, and it was 70 in the mid 70s when I got up this morning, so it wasn't too bad.
That's well, we have our house has air conditioning that is zoned. We have two different air conditioners because they added on to our house well before we bought it. The back one, it's like they take turns, right? So the front one, it's just rigged really weird. And there's a pan with the float. And if the front one runs continuously too much, the pan fills up and everything, it doesn't trip the breaker. The thermostat just goes dead and it stops working. And so we had the opposite problem a couple weeks ago where the front air conditioner, the thermostat wouldn't shut off. Like even when you shut it off, it just kept running. So we're like, great. Couldn't turn it up. We had it turned up to like 85 just to see if it would stop. It wouldn't. No. So we got a new thermostat in the front. And then we wake up one morning in the back and I'm like, why is it so hot back here? And the breaker is tripped and it kept tripping. And we had to call the AC guy out because that one's, you know, there's stuff in the attic and they air conditioning. Blah. I'm going to go live in a pasture somewhere where there's just cool breezes. It'll be much better.
Good segue.
This time of year, I think they're still hot. I think it's just hot breezes in the pastures.
Well, if we would let our... So that is the voice of this week's guest, who I, of course, once again have forgotten to introduce, and I know listeners expect no less from me. This is Annie Moscato, and we're going to talk about cows today, and specifically why pastures are not air-conditioned, because I know a lot of you have written in with that question. No? That's not it? I get confused.
Everyone is wondering.
So I think we should just say this one visual note, since people aren't seeing us, that Kathy has changed her background and now she has a pair of horns behind her head and she looks like Loki.
I'm here for it, man. I mean, we could all use a little Nordic energy every now and then. I am pretty sure the picture, which I will happily use for the episode art, is a Florida cow, because where else would I travel other than Florida? And it is probably, if I'm thinking about it, it is probably a cow from Kissimmee. It is from Kissimmee, Lake Kissimmee State Park, where they have some of the region's descendants of some of Florida's first cows, allegedly. Annie, you are the bovine expert. We're going to defer to you if that's true.
And I don't actually know as much about the literal cows as I do the cattle ranching and environmentalism and the Florida
cow. You don't know every cow in Florida?
Not personally, but if it is at the Kissimmee State Park, then it would be a Florida cracker cow, which are the closest things we have to the original cattle brought over by the Spaniards in the 1500s.
Which were the Andalusians, right?
Yeah, they're very, very hardy, like all things native at this point, considered native, as close as you can get to a domestic animal, native to Florida. So smaller, scrappier, can live on sort of a hardier forage, very heat tolerant, naturally sort of immune to a lot of the pests and things that we have. Florida's a hard place to live physically, right?
Like they don't have air conditioning.
Air conditioning, Well, I grew up with my mom and grandparents talking about mosquito control and air conditioning is what ruined the state, because then everybody came here. If we didn't have mosquito control and air conditioning, everyone would have stayed away.
We also, when we had mosquito control, lost a lot of butterflies. And I think something happened with all those kids who used to chase the truck at night.
Yeah. Like me.
No, I always think, and you're worried about clay dust now. I always think about the first Euro-Americans who arrived here. And, you know, anybody, you don't have to go far off the beaten trail in Florida to think this. If you do it enough, you'll find yourself wondering, like, what made them keep going? Like, I just can't imagine hitting anything west of what we now call the Buccaneer Trail in the northeast part of the state and just saying, you know what, this seems like a great idea. Let's keep going. And now picture them doing it with a head of cattle, because the cows, you know, cows, I could just picture these poor little cows, and they are little cows compared to what you think of. I just picture these cows going, oh, hell no. No, we're not doing this. But they persisted, and here we are. How do these little cows taste? Do you know?
I mean, they taste like beef.
Okay. Where can one buy?
The biggest difference you'd be able to taste with any meat breed is if it's pasture-raised or traditionally corn-fed, because we have a lot of corn-fed beef in the United States. So that is where I think there's a bigger taste, and I think probably most people would agree with me, the difference in grass-fed beef versus finished beef. So traditionally, our commercially produced beef is finished in feedlots, typically in the Midwest. So Florida doesn't really have feedlots. That's not really part of our agricultural industry. So in Florida, we're a cow-calf state. So our cows are on pasture all the time. The herds for the most part. And then, so they're living on grass. They're not being fed corn or soybean. And then at the very end of their life to be processed, then they're loaded up onto trailers and brought typically to the Midwest to a feedlot, where they would be for 4 to 6 weeks, finished on corn and then processed. And then, so that's what you buy in Publix or Walmart or wherever you're buying your beef, unless you are intentionally buying grass fed beef, which you can find in Florida. A lot of our commercial cattle ranches now are offering both options. Grass-fed beef is more expensive for a lot of reasons. It takes longer than they have more time with them on the pastures, and you can only raise so many cows per acre, right? And sustain your pasture and have it be environmentally productive. And then we don't have the same level of finishing meat processing facilities in Florida, because that's not typically what our industry was. Typically, they were shipped out west. So the grass-fed is a little bit pricier. So most places, if they offer that, they still also offer the more traditional corn-finished beef, because it has a lower price point, so it makes it more accessible to folks.
It is. That was a lot that you just said, but that is...
I do go true academic here sometimes.
No, but it's okay, because it is ecologically, environmentally, health-wise, planetarily, globally, planetarily, is that a word? That's all very significant, what you just said, because there is a book, and I'll put the link in the show notes. Omnivore's Dilemma is probably one of the books I would say, if you're listening to this and your ears just perked up at grass-fed and grass-finished and feedlots and all that, The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan is, there is a chapter on cows, specifically beef cows. And it's a little heartbreaking. Actually, the whole book is heartbreaking. It makes you want to grow your own food and, you know, just bathe in mud and live in a cave again, which I'm sure is exactly what he intended when he wrote it. But there's a lot of things into how we produce food now. And there were some other documentaries that came out. Food Inc. was one of them, that made you think, well, I don't want to buy any commercially processed beef at all anymore. I will save you the whole abattoirness of the Omnivore's Dilemma and the cattle on the feedlot. But I think the least that, if you are not an informed, cattle-informed, beef cattle-informed person, the least that you need to know is the way that we raise food in the United States is not how your great-grandparents raised food in the United States. It's not two beef cows out back, you know, one gives milk, the other two cows are for food. It's not even the city slickers thing where they race the cattle across pastures and, you know, you've got Billy Crystal and It's not like that anymore. It is one of the least humane ways to raise food, the way we raise and process cattle in the United States. And it's heartbreaking, right? Because I do not eat a lot of meat, but every now and then I really do want a steak or I want a burger. And 9 times out of 10, the Beyond Beef, the Impossible Burger will do it for me, but sometimes I want a burger. So it can feel like simply by ordering a steak in a restaurant, you are part of the problem. And it gets overwhelming. It definitely gets overwhelming, especially, you know, like I said, reading Omnivore's Dilemma, watching the documentary Food Inc., you just start to feel like, God, why do I even bother? But then there's somebody like Annie, like you, and some of the Florida cattlemen who are actually working to change this. And when you say things, Annie, like, we don't do feedlots in Florida. We're a calf-cow state. I want to really make sure people understand why that is so significant. Not just, you know, I realize and recognize that some of the people here will be like, well, I don't care how the cow feels, but not just for the cow and the calf, but for the planet and for Florida. I mean, it's one of these things that I really think makes Florida a little special and not special in the news prurient interest of the public way. So, you know, we have not all cattle ranchers in Florida, obviously, but you wrote a paper that I'm not going to make you read word for word on the show today. But you wrote
that's good because it's long.
It is long, and that's we are limited. But you did write a paper about exactly this up at UF, and I think the idea of sustainability and cattle ranching and cattle—I hate to call it cattle farming because it really is cattle ranching. You know, there is a component of conservation. There is a component of a little bit more of a kindness that may not be for altruistic reasons in how some cattle ranchers in Florida are handling their industry. So I'll shut up now. I'm going to let you talk. And we will put a link to your very long paper in the show notes because I can think of at least two people who listen to the show who will want to read it. And it's called From Cattle to Conservation.
By paper, it's a doctoral dissertation. So no one reads it in full. I'm confident my academic advisor probably didn't actually read the entire thing in full. So feel free to skip around. If you are listening and reading, just read the parts that seem interesting.
Well, so do you want to respond to what Kathy just said?
That whole 10-minute diatribe Kathy just gave us?
It's interesting because part of what I was actually studying was the ecological humility of cattle ranchers. So humility that develops from working with the land for your entire life, working alongside the land. And it was driven in part by the fact that my background is science communication, and particularly in the ag and natural resource sectors. And there is so much misinformation all the time as you can imagine, in science communication in general, but particularly in agriculture, a lot of it around beef cattle and beef cattle production. And in Florida, and growing up in Florida and being a Floridian and caring very much about the state, I grew up in Fort Pierce surrounded by cattle ranches. I did day work on my horse moving cows in high school for like $20 a day or something dumb because I loved being out on the ranches. So it was an area that I felt very passionately about and really my soapbox area where I would get the most frustrated when I would hear that misinformation because I could see sort of this paradox of, well, cows are killing the earth, but I'm in Florida where it's one of the few things saving the earth. Like we have an incredibly unique ecosystem within the state of Florida that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So if we lose it, it's gone. As y'all know, and I'm sure all of your listeners know, I found a great quote from a research project when I was writing the dissertation from someone who's an environmental conservationist, does that sort of research. And she said, rancher versus environmentalist has been a longstanding trope, but in the Sunshine State, ranching just may be the last best hope for ecological salvation. And that reality and how challenging it can be to get out to the general public is a lot of what drove this, because the reality is that we've lost something like 300,000 acres of land to urban development in the state of Florida in the last 10 years. And if you're talking about the Florida Wildlife Corridor, which is important for all of its own reasons, that wildlife corridors are critically important to conservation anywhere, but especially in somewhere like a peninsula where species can't sort of redirect. So you have to be intentional about creating one. Of the 18 million acres that makes up the Florida Wildlife Corridor, 10 million acres of that are working cattle ranches. So you have 20% of it that relies on cattle ranching. And managed grazing has been named one of the methods most effective for limiting global warming. So when you have strategically managed grasslands, it can contribute positively to carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere and has a positive contribution to soil carbon sequestration. So when you talk about cattle ranching and you look at the sort of global research or where the books are written, they are looking at someplace like Brazil where they're going in and they're tearing down native forests and they're planting pasture land and they're planting row crops to feed the cows in a feedlot versus in Florida, the overwhelming majority. So more than half of all agricultural land in Florida is cattle ranching. That is our number one agricultural industry. And the overwhelming majority of it is all native grasslands. So it's grasslands that existed. No one is tearing down trees to make pastures on a huge cattle ranch because we already have them. That's how we ended up with cattle ranching as our biggest industry to begin with.
Did we ever tear down trees to make cattle ranches?
So you can do some. I'm sure there's been some clearing of some areas for individual pastures, but it would be minimal in part because you actually need those areas. So cattle ranchers are in many ways the first, and I mean this very literally, the first intentional environmental conservationist in the state of Florida. If you look historically, and it was just because they were working the land so closely, they understood in the ways that they do still now, we have to conserve water. So you have to leave this part swamp because of the way the water is connected, because you need water for cows. So if you fill in a swamp, then you've now stopped all the water running off of it, and now you don't have water for your cows in their pastures. So Florida actually lended itself really beautifully to being able to raise cattle. You need some oak hammocks where they can go get out of the shade, and they can get up on dry land in the wet season when the swampier areas are flooding. So they're not focused on just having grass because cattle rely so much more on that. And you need the large tracts of land because it takes so many acres per cow to sustain a cow on grass. If you're not feeding them corn and you're not feeding them soybeans. And as I was doing the research, I started to ask then, okay, well, are they hurting then the pasture, right? Like it has cows on it. There are native things that live in a native grassland. And I started talking to one of our wildlife ecologists at the University of Florida, and they were studying, and now I cannot remember the type of it. It's a little tiny like sparrow that lives in grassland specifically. And we are the only place in the world that has it. They only exist in Florida. And they said that they admittedly, when they went into studying the impacts of cattle on it, they were anticipating that it would be detrimental to the bird, that you would have like cows. And what they found is that they actually thrive and they have increasing populations of them in the pasture that's grazed. For a variety of reasons. One, that the cattle are naturally sort of pulling out the weeds and keeping the native grasslands maintained. That part of it is with predators, that the cows could keep some of their natural predators down a little bit, which allowed the birds to sort of revitalize. It's scarier to go try and catch a bird if you're like a small bobcat when there's a 1,000-pound, you know, cow wandering around.
Cows can team up too. They can.
People don't realize. So, my fun fact about cows is that more of them kill people every year than wolves in the United States. Ooh. Everybody wants a pet cow, and you know, cows are dangerous.
You know,
animals.
I've run across. There's a place called Kilby Trail on the St. John's River where I've run across you know big steers and stuff, and they are scary animals. That's when I turn around and go the other way. When I see them, when they have horns like Kathy has, that's when I get a little scared of them. They're very intimidating.
It's just the sheer body size. This was the other interviewing cattle ranchers. That was actually one of the themes that came up in my dissertation is how many of them ended up in ICU multiple times from cows. Like it's just part
wow.
of it.
Wow. Interesting.
I want an attack cow now. Screw German. I mean, we already look. You just said cows kill more people than basically wild dogs, wolves. I know that's an oversimplification. Yeah. We do have somebody who lives in our neighborhood who has a small cow. I just have to real quickly share this story. I don't condone it. She has a cow. During Hurricane Irma, the cow escaped And the cow made it to the front yard of a woman who owns a restaurant in town, which I think is very funny. And the cow's name was Kobe. But anyway, I think let's stop for a second. Are you talking about the grasshopper sparrow or the Baird sparrow or another one?
I don't remember. It was a type of sparrow.
Yeah. So cows protect birds from bobcats.
They theorize. So they're not entirely sure, right? This is how science works very often, is you find a correlation. It can be a statistically valid correlation. We studied enough grassland and enough birds with enough cows that we're confident in this, but they didn't definitively know why, because there's so many things it could be. But one of the theories is that predation would be lowered simply by the cows existing, but the cows didn't do anything that was detrimental to the sparrow.
Can I ask a question about a project that came up in the last 20 years that I've kind of lost track of? It was, I heard about it. It was originally called the Adena Springs Ranch. It was supposed to be over there by Silver Springs. A Canadian billionaire wanted to convert all this land within the Silver Springs spring shed to a cattle country. And at one point, he wanted to take a permit to withdraw a great deal of water in order to feed the cattle. And then at one point, he backed off the amount of water. And then I kind of lost track of what happened with it. Are you familiar with that? And that, he rebranded it. It was, I think it called, he changed the name to something like Plum Creek. He was a, car parts is how he made his money. He was a gazillionaire and he built a big golf course. I think the golf course is there north of Ocala, kind of between Ocala and Silver Springs. And so there was a big protest actually that I was part of, because the amount of water that he wanted the permit to withdraw from the aquifer was larger than, you know, the amount of water used by the city of Ocala at that point.
And he wanted it for commercial cattle production. It wasn't one of those, like, it's a subdivision where we pretend we're like 5-acre ranchettes and we pretend we're ranching.
Yes, I'm pretty sure that there is some cattle production there now, but it's a greatly reduced number because it was extravagant what he wanted. So you don't know about
there
that.
Is some I have in to that dig it up. Area, because that's where the wildlife corridor right there relies on a lot of the cattle ranches in that area to exist. Right there. So I know.
But
there
so
is
this this wasn't historic cattle ranching, you know, at all. This was a case where he was converting it into cattle ranching. And so there was environmentalists like myself, you know, really got fed up. And we actually did a protest that was somewhat successful. But it's not the historic.
Pulling from the aquifer for it seems that puts off some, makes me wonder if it was more development or saying cattle ranching. I don't know. I haven't heard anything about it, but my dad is a development attorney. So I lean towards, oh, that doesn't.
I have to do a Google search, see what I can find out, because I just kind of lost track of it, because it seemed like things had shifted enough. And but I do think the golf course got built, and this wasn't, you know, this isn't what we're talking about. You know, the historic ranchers who've been there for generations and generations who are good stewards of the environment. This is somebody kind of making a land grab from Canada and wanting to convert this land that I think was mostly undeveloped.
That's interesting, too, because the profit margins are so slim. So I interviewed one. As you can imagine, most ranchers in Florida are multi-generation, simply because you can't buy the land and have it make money. You would lose money forever. But I interviewed one rancher who, they are a first generation. It is she and her husband. His family did dairy cows, so they were familiar with cows, but they were shifting to beef cattle. So they were working with 1,000 acres, which is relatively small if you're running a large scale operation, because it does take so many acres per cow. But they would not have been able to do that without conservation easements. Like, to do it, it required selling their houses and mortgaging everything and taking out a huge loan that she said she doesn't even know if they'll be able to pay back in their lifetime. And that on top of that, they still wouldn't have been able to do it without the legal conservation agreements that were then subsidizing part of that land to maintain it. So I would be suspicious of anyone who says they're coming in to buy land to make money off cattle, because they're not going to make money off of it. They're going to lose money every year forever.
Well, there's a tax break.
Yeah, there were some suspicious elements for sure.
Yeah, there's right. there is a tax break with conservation.
Well, isn't there also an agriculture tax break too?
There's an agricultural exemption.
The villages, I don't know if they still do, but the villages, which is its own special taxing district, and it covers, I think, 3 counties in Florida now, they for a long time would keep either bison or buffalo on part of their property to be able to get that exemption. So,
and it's every county is different. So like St. Lucie County, where I was growing up, we leased the land that I lived on to a cattle rancher who didn't own his own large plot of land because it's too expensive to get into it. So he leased like 10 and 20 and 50 acre parcels from folks to run actually cracker cows on. So I had cracker cows at my house that we did not own. And in St. Lucie County, they give you the ag exemption for the entire piece if it has an actual ag purpose. In Alachua County, where I am now, they come out every year to check, and they will not give it to you for the acre your house is on. So I have agricultural exemption on my land, but in Alachua County, I pay one amount for the acre with my house, and then I pay a different amount for the rest of the property that's being used for ag. So it's county dependent. But there is an agricultural exemption, largely because, as you can imagine, if you look at what the taxes are on your house and an acre of land versus, 2 acres, if you, make that, multiply it by 1,000, you wouldn't have anyone doing any agriculture in Florida. You would have no farms. You would have no farms and no cows.
Yeah.
You would only have concrete houses.
Wow. Which seems like sometimes that's the direction we're headed, I'm afraid.
Yeah, there's so much more to talk about here, too. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Annie.
Oh, no, you're fine.
I wanted to ask if these cattle ranchers, I mean, there's a whole bunch more that we can't possibly cover in the few minutes we had remaining. What about, like, when we talk about the environmental benefits and the environmental harm, what about the methane emissions? What about contamination along the Kissimmee River Valley? Are they doing anything about that, or is it more of a passive protection?
So I think it's not passive protection at all. I don't want to say all, because there's always the one outlier, right? But as close to all as you can get, they are all actively involved in conservation. Even the ones that don't have a formal land conservation agreement, which most of them have at least some, there is not one that I ever worked with, no one I talked to for my dissertation, who was not doing some kind of water, intentional water management, resource management, obviously the pasture management. All of them talked about their frustrations with invasive species. All of them are doing things to try and get rid of, like, kudzu, right? The Brazilian peppers. Everyone fights Brazilian peppers forever and ever. Amen. So they are all doing some aspect of that. And as a whole, that's reflected in, if you look up the Florida Cattlemen Association's current mission and vision statement, if you look at their president's remarks, if you look at their annual report every year, they're not just doing it. They're actively talking about it and intentional about it as an industry and an association, and very much holding each other accountable to that. A large number that I talked to who had formerly conserved land talked about calling their peers in the cattle industry to be like, hey, you need to conserve part of this too. Like, we have to make sure that this stays. One of them talked about one of his colleagues who he's been ranching alongside for 50 years, got an offer from a developer and called him because he was thinking about taking it because he doesn't have kids and grandkids who want to go into this. It's hard. It's every single day, and cows hurt you, and it's hot, and you never get a day off, and your profit margins aren't huge. And so
cows hurt you.
If you can sell your property and you can set your family up to have millions of dollars, then how do you not take that? And as a human, I think that's a fair point, and that's a fair consideration, is how do you ask then generations who don't want to do this to do this? So the gentleman that I was talking to said, I told him, and I think I wrote about this in my dissertation, like verbatim what he said, but he's like, I told him that you love this land and you know this land. And if you sell out to that developer, then there's going to be generations after this, even outside your family, who will never know what this land is like and who will never experience this. So this is your moral responsibility. Most of them identify as Christians, and for them, it's very tied to religion. They take it as a privilege and a responsibility to manage the land because it is God's creation, and the cows are God's creation, and the plants are God's creation, and they were put here. And so they have a moral obligation to it, which I think is that frustration and that paradox, right? Of the general public doesn't, how often does the general public interact with a cattle rancher? And you see things like the documentaries and you see the feedlots and it's, there is a level of sensationalism, right? With all things. And we know that with all things. But in Florida, we have such a unique cattle industry and it is so closely tied to environmental conservation. We have the environmental conservation that we have because of cattle ranchers. For a long time, it was our largest industry. It's second only to tourism. And before we had Disney World, tourism didn't touch cattle ranching.
It's interesting because I've been studying a lot of the history of Orlando because they're celebrating the 150th anniversary. And cattle ranching was the big thing before citrus. And then citrus came along and kind of, you know, was taken over by tourism. But then, you know, Osceola County to the south has always been a big, big cow country, which brings me to a question about, are you familiar with Desiree Ranch, the land owned by the Church of Latter-day Saints? And they are trying to develop that.
They're an exception to the cattle ranching rule.
Are they?
Like, because they're not doing it for the same reasons, right?
No.
For them, it was a land acquisition with the intention of development at some point, and they could afford to sink money by raising cows, right? They could afford to be losing money because they have, as an organization, they have way more money than any individual would unless they're a billionaire.
Yeah.
So they could be acquiring land and do something with it and take a profit loss.
So,
because then you could hold it to develop it. So I think they are the outlier.
Isn't the impact, you know, I'm thinking about the impact that will have on Central Florida. It's enormous, you know, just in water resources alone, if they developed all that land, because it's a huge piece of land.
And I learned about that and the concern about it from cattle ranchers. Like the cattle ranchers are concerned about that. I spoke with several ranchers who would not be comfortable with me saying their names publicly, but who have reached out to them to try and buy it from them. Like they themselves are trying to figure out how to get some of that just as individuals. Like, what will you sell me? How can we get together the money for it? So it is a valid concern.
Wow. Annie, thank you. This is fascinating to me. Rick does not eat beef, so I don't know if he's going to be tempted to go find some Florida. No. Okay.
No, but I honestly, I think the ranchers are heroes. I think they're contemporary Florida heroes. And that's, you know, more power to them.
That's fantastic. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
That's our t-shirt this week.
And if you are worried about the environmental impacts, then you get Florida grass-fed beef and then it was never shipped anywhere else. It was born here and raised here and processed here and sustained the grassland, and you be intentional about that choice as a consumer. And I think that beef you could eat and feel good about.
Yeah.
That is actually almost, we always buy grass fed when we buy, and we're always looking for Florida grass fed when we can, grass fed and finished. So, Annie, thank you for coming on the show, folks. We have a lot of links in the show notes and, appreciate you coming out today. Thanks so much for joining us. As always, Rick and I are oh so grateful to our supporters who support us with cold hard cash money. You know, Rick, I don't know if you're aware, but we're not getting rich.
Yeah, I'm aware, but you know what? I like to think we're moving the needle a little bit and just creating awareness about cool things in Florida.
We are. I think we get good responses. People respond to individual podcast episodes. And then when I do my monthly newsletter, it's not that unusual for people to respond to something that was in the podcast. And we do send out little gifts. And I do have to say, I accidentally sent one out to somebody that I guess she must have canceled because she doesn't show up in our list. So Carrie, if you get a gift in the mail, keep it. It's yours. Sorry about that. But thank you for the times when you did subscribe. So I do want to thank the people who currently subscribe. When you subscribe to our podcast, not only do you get to have me probably mispronounce your name, you get nifty stuff in the mail. And the more you give us every month, the more stuff you get. So with that, do you want me to start with the newest or the most seasoned subscriber? Rick?
Start with the newest so people aren't used to hearing their name get to hear it.
Stephanie Hewley. Thank you.
Yay.
Brad Sager. Brian Woodall or Woodall. He was the guy who won the Florida Bucket List Adventure Pack. And then he subscribed and now I follow him on Instagram and I like seeing. If you take pictures traveling around Florida, please follow me on Instagram so I can follow you back because I love seeing where y'all go. The Betts Boys Adventure, they are two younger men who are not even, I think, preteen yet. And it's kind of an unusual situation because they subscribe at, technically, I guess their dad subscribes at the highest level. And they, he does YouTube videos of them traveling all over the country. And, you know, when you subscribe at the $10 a month level, we try and send you, you know, Florida ephemera. But I am always hyper aware that with the Betts boys, there's two, basically, I don't want to call them little boys, but younger boys who probably don't care about. So the $10 a month subscribers this month all got coffee mugs, Florida Spectacular coffee mugs.
Cool.
Well, but the Betts, what are two like 8 and 10 year old boys going to do with a coffee mug? So when we were coming back from the Keys, I stopped by Big Cypress to see what they had at the visitor center there. And I found a book about Panthers that was age appropriate. And then I found one of the Carl Hyacin books. I think it was Hoot. And I mailed it to them. So,
aww.
Yeah. And then I found out that apparently when they had been at Big Cypress a few months ago, the older of the two Betts boys had actually gotten, I think, either Flush or one of the other Carl Hyacin books. So I felt like, I mean, man, I should not be a mother. I am the crazy aunt. I am the person you don't want on speakerphone because of my mouth. But at least with these two kids, I got something right. So I'm very encouraged about that. If you are listening and have a child and you subscribe, I promise not to drop F-bombs in the postcards I send to you. But otherwise, make no promises. So those are the Betts Boys Adventure. Follow them on YouTube. Elise Smith, who drove from South Florida to come see me at a talk in Palm Harbor months ago, which I thought was cool. Carol Miller, Leslie Hallweg, Davita Breyer, who is not only a subscriber, we have become friends. We've met exactly once. And this week she sent me in the mail a little tiny pin of Creature from the Black Lagoon. And the creature is holding the woman. And I'm just, I like it when I get swag. Natalie Zachrick, Angela Connolly, John Bowne, Ryan Worthington, who he and I have started a Facebook group called Submerged Stories to talk about history in Florida that is underrepresented. So Black history, Asian American history, female history, American Indian history, backwoods history, not just people of color, all the histories that are not talked about in the history classes. So you probably want to check out Submerged Stories Facebook group, Submerged Stories Hidden History of Florida. And of course, our very first subscriber ever, Michael Gargalak, who I've never met and know nothing about, only that he was the first one to go, hell yes, I will give them money.
I thought.
Yes.
I'm liking your new group and I like finding cool stories. And I just thought of something I wanted to post because it's a great place for these, you know, like Fort Mosey. It's a great avenue to get shine a light on these stories that haven't been talked about enough.
Yeah. I mean, we don't talk about so much of Florida's history. Because I think sometimes, I hate to say this, it makes me sound so anti. I had very good history teachers, but they were limited by what they were taught and what they knew. And it's just, they only teach what they know. And when you're only giving people, textbooks and you're getting these people to teach history who, you know, when I was in high school, some of my history teachers were athletics coaches. And, you know, that doesn't qualify you to talk about all these things in history. So you use the textbook. And I'm sure they were excellent coaches and good teachers, but we don't put the priority on history in a lot of places. One, it doesn't make you money if you take it. You know, you get a kid who's a whiz bang in math and you push that, right? Because, oh, he's going to be an engineer. He's going to be an actuary. He's going to be a CPA. You get a kid who thinks critically about history and you're like, God, she's a pain in the ass. I assume, because it doesn't pay. Like, that's how we reward things. But, you know, it leaves a lot of history out when we don't focus on history like we do some other things that lead to profitable careers. I don't think there's ever been a history teacher or a historian who's gotten rich. I'm trying to think of one desperately. Like, yes, you win the Pulitzer, and I think there's some money with that, but that's it, right?
Doris Kearns Goodwin, David, what's his name? Oh, where's that book? It used to be on my shelf. Is it David McCullough?
Were they rich, though?
No, I mean, not rich,
so
rich.
That's not that that matters. That's not a scorecard, right? But that's how academia works, is, you know.
I think that the key to me in all of this is that our perception of history is fluid. And it's you know, we talk about it like these are facts set in stone, but then you learn more and your perspective changes in it. You know, like I think our whole view of Native Americans, the early indigenous people who lived in the state, is constantly evolving. And, you know, you say people are here 10,000 years ago, then it's learned they may have been here 12,000 years ago, then it may have been 20,000 years ago. And we're just learning more and more all the time. And, you know, I think the key is to have an open mind. I think that's the big thing.
Well, it's not as black and white as people think, right?
No, so definitely not.
We grow up learning history in an academic setting, and you think that those are the facts. There were 13 original colonies in the United States, and we all joined together and had a revolution because the king was bad. And then you find out that, yeah, the king probably was not a great guy, but you know what? There weren't 13 colonies. There were 22. And a lot of people didn't think it was a great idea. And that's hard for people. Like, things that you, that's like, if you go back and tell somebody, hey, this man who raised you is not your dad, they're going to at first reject that too. Because
yeah,
it's
people,
just hard.
People love the things they've learned and they don't want, it's threatening, I think, for people to reevaluate things that are kind of foundational beliefs. And a lot of that is, you know, like simple stuff, like, you know, the term crackers. Everybody learns that it's from the cracking of the whip of the cracker cowman, which is, you know, appropriate for what we're talking about today. But, you know, the term, the pejorative term cracker, is found in Shakespeare, which far predates, you know, the cracker cowman in Florida. And that, you know, people have done the research and said that, you know, it's, you know, it's nice to kind of get incorporate that story of the cracker whips, but there was people being put down, being called crackers long before there were whips being cracked in Florida. And people hate that, you know, they don't want to learn a different explanation for the origins of that term.
No. And you know, we reject any changes. We are very clearly not okay with changes to things that we think are canon. And it's hard. I mean, I gave a talk about the Seminole War phase in Florida's history, which we are now moving away slowly, ever so slowly, almost invisibly, from calling them three separate Seminole Wars to the Seminole War phase, because there was, in reality, from 1811 till the start of the Civil War, never a point in Florida's history where the government was not actively hunting, trying to kill, trying to capture, trying to relocate the people who now are known as the Miccosukee, the Creek, the Seminole. And I gave this talk, and we talked about the Trail of Tears, which included the Voyage of Tears that brought people across the Gulf of Mexico up to the Mississippi River and joined the rest of the Indians, American Indians. And at the end of this, man came up to me, goes, well, some of them wanted to go. And I said, sir, nobody wanted to go. And I said, there are zero stories of American Indians saying, yes, I want to go to Oklahoma. It's actually zero stories of anybody ever saying they want to go to Oklahoma. But he couldn't accept it. He's like, no. And somewhere in his history, someone had told him that some of the Indians loved the idea of having all this land or something, because he just couldn't get his head around it. And
yeah.
You know, it's upsetting to people, but the reality, I always go back to that African proverb, until lions have historians, tales of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. And, you know, it's a more eloquent way of saying history is written by the winners.
Yes.
It's been, You know, it's fascinating to me. I know a woman who grew up in Pinellas County, same as me, but she's Black. She knows things about American history that I am just now learning. Things that were not taught to her in a history class, but that the history has been kept orally for generations. And that to me is really amazing, because we white European American people think of history about what you can open a textbook and read. But there's all these other cultures who have been disenfranchised by that model of learning. So they've kept their own history. And you know, that's one of the reasons we have the Facebook group, is we think it's time to really make that history as visible as the things you can pick up and read.
And that, you know, that history is also under attack right now. So I think it's important to
What? I didn't know that.
Yes, you did.
I know I did.
It's tough. It's really tough. And, I kind of liked where we were going. You know, the opposite side of that is it's hard to stay current. And, you know, there is this thing that you could get canceled if you say something the wrong way. Like I'd never heard of this, you know, I was just getting comfortable with, instead of calling it three separate Seminole Wars, calling it the whole conflict, the Seminole Wars, the Seminole War. What did you call it? The Seminole War phase?
Seminole War phase is how I've heard it.
I've not heard that. That's a whole new thing for me to learn.
I don't think they'll be upset. I don't think anybody's going to be upset if you call it the Seminole War conflict or the Seminole. I think the big thing is within the Seminole Tribe of Florida, the big thing, of course, is that you acknowledge that there weren't times of peace, that there were never times of peace.
I see. Right?
That's the big, 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 big thing. And, you know, that's not what I learned in college, yeah. Or, you know, my two units of Florida history that I got in fourth grade and seventh grade as a public school student. But, you know, it's evolving. Like, our knowledge of how we teach and interpret history is evolving. I had bought, because I love these books, years ago, I had bought a Idiot's Guide to World History. And because I kind of slept on world history in high school. You know, it was taught by kind of a dick. I hope he's not still alive. Pretty sure he's not listening to this podcast if he is. 10th grade, you know, European history. And it was all out of a textbook. And I, you know, my brain wasn't there yet. I was really good at reading, but my brain was not there yet. And I didn't love the class. So I know I missed a lot of stuff. And so I bought this book years ago and I picked it up the other day. I'm like, you know what? I'll read a chapter a day. And I found myself going through the book, making notes whenever there was colonialism. Like, well, wait a minute, what about this? And, you know, it completely omits the idea of any cultures starting anywhere in the so-called New World. Everything starts in one place. And I'm scrawling these notes like, well, have we even looked? And what about this? And, you know, how did the people who were there feel about it? And I am a very combative consumer of traditional history at this point, I think is the best way to put it. Which is how we should think about history, right? Like, these narratives are written by one group and it's a battle. It's a battle. There's a saying that journalists or newspapers write the first draft of history, and it's a battle in our newsroom to make sure that we're not only make sure that we're not ignoring any side of the story, but that we're also not artificially inflating one side of the story. Like, one of my reporters put it this way the other day. He's like, so, you know, if somebody shows up at a city council meeting and says, the mayor is just three geckos in a trench coat, it's our job to say somebody showed up and said this, but it's not our job to track down an expert who will give equal weight to that side of the story. Because yeah. Not only does that portray the story wrong now, when people go back and read those accounts in 200 years, they're going to think that was an equally weighty argument. So, I mean, all the ways we interpret history is based on what was written or said at the time. And that can in and of itself be very flawed. And I feel like we're going into a whole nother podcast episode.
Yeah, we are.
We should probably get Ryan on to talk about the submerged stories sometime soon.
Oh, that's a great idea. Ryan's always a great guest, and maybe he, you know, he's very attuned to what's going on in Tallahassee and maybe could bring us up to date after this last legislative session.
Yeah. Well, so. I'm going to go finish this. I'm probably going to go down to Alligator Alcatraz and maybe break some people out. So
watch out for the pythons.
I'm not worried about the pythons. Ice is what scares me. And we just lost a listener somewhere, I'm sure. All right, folks, thanks for listening to our protracted shout out to those of you supporting the podcast. We will see you next time on the Florida Spectacular.
I think it's good. We started with air conditioning and ended with ice. It seems like we went full circle.
I like to keep it, you know, I like to keep it like that. I like to keep things fresh and bring it full circle, maybe work a little symbolism in. It's all good.
All right. Bye.
Bye.